We hope and trust that you will find this Torah in Motion program meaningful. Through these programs, Torah in Motion encourages discussion, debate, and education about the most important issues facing Jews and Judaism today. Together, we can focus on creating religious commitment through an honest and sophisticated encounter with topics that are relevant to being Jewish in the modern world. For more information about this and other Torah in Motion programs, please visit the website at www.torahinmotion.org.
Okay, those who have cupped it out all day, a special Yashar Koyach, we can be a little bit more informal. I can't say as many chokes as our last speaker. I apologize in advance. Okay, twice a year, we fast, beginning at nightfall, and twice a year, there are the five prohibitions associated with the day of fasting, unlike the other fast days, of course, which only start in the morning. Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur are linked, as Rabbi Hochman spoke, I think, earlier, about the linkage we know between Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av. But really, the fasting is very, very different, as we all know, that's been alluded to. Yom Kippur is a fast day of joy. That the Gemara says there were no happier days for the Jewish people, except for the days of Tu B'Av, which we'll have next week, on Wednesday, I guess, and Yom HaKippurim. And it was a day of marriage, and because the marriage, the reuniting with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, meant you have to get married to a spouse. Because as the Rambam writes in Hilchot Shuva, one of the main purposes of marriage is that each spouse elevates the other in Avodat Hashem. That's the connection between why Yom Kippur, they also had marriages, just like on Tu B'Av in the afternoon, and that's why we read the parsha of who you can and cannot marry on Yom Kippur afternoon. Yom Kippur is a very happy day. It's a very uplifting day. We are angels. We have a new start. We're recreating our communion with, I don't know if that is the right words, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Really, the Yom Kippur is a two-day holiday. Beginning on the 9th of Tishrei, we cannot eat on Yom Kippur. So we have to have the eating to celebrate. The holiday of Yom Kippur is done on the 9th of Tishrei. That's why the Gemara says in the Chumash, Yom Kippur starts Pitisha Be'era. The ninth, it's 2 days Yom Kippur. There's one day of eating and celebration. As the Gemara says, whoever fasts on Yom Kippur is as if, or whoever eats on the ninth, is as if they had fasted 2 days, because it's connected. Different themes. The theme of physical happiness on Yom Kippur, and on Erev Yom Kippur, on the first day of Yom Kippur, and on the second day of Yom Kippur, on Yud Tishrei, the theme of spiritual growth. But Yom Kippur, both days are happy days. Tisha B'Av, we know, is the exact opposite. Tisha B'Av, whether it's tragedy, whether it's avelis or tshuva, it is both. But there clearly is avelis. On Tisha B'Av, we're sad. Yom Kippur, we stand. Yom Kippur, the Shechina is here. We stand. We take out all the Sifrei Torah. And everybody stands up. Because the Shechina is the most close. We're angels. Baruch Shem Kvod Malchut Olam Ve'ed. And on Tisha B'Av, the Shechina has gone away. We said in many of the keynote, the Shechina isn't here. Shalom, it's the exact opposite. It's the same actions. But it's the exact opposite theme and motif from Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur. But interestingly, there's only one part of our liturgy that links Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av. And that's, of course, the famous story of the Asara Harugei Malchut, of the 10 martyrs who were martyred by the Romans. So this is, we say, in the middle of in Yom Kippur, when everybody is going home, only all the serious people are left. I shouldn't say, Yom Kippur, in the middle of the Avoda there, they throw it in at 3 o'clock, everybody wants a break already. So we say, Eila Eskara, our recall of what happened, and we begin the recitation of the Asara Harugei Malchut. We say, of course, on Tisha B'Av Arzei Havanam, I actually didn't say it here. That was one of the keynotes I skipped because I said I'll talk about it later. But we talk about the Asara Harugei Malchut. Now, the truth of the matter is, this is a very difficult story. Who exactly were these Asara Harugei Malchut? So the first thing you have to know is there is no one version of the story. And this, the keynote here that I have, which is a wonderful book. It's great with all the explanations. So they quote 8 versions of the story. And of course, 8 versions, so at least 9 groups of rabbis. that you have. Who are they exactly the Asarah HaRuge Malchut? They agree on most of them, but there is no one list exactly who these Asarah HaRuge Malchut is. Of course, what's even more problematic is they didn't, of course, live at the same time. Rabbi Yishmael, who is the first, we'll read about him in a moment, was the Kohen Gadol. He lived in the time of the temple. Rabbi Akiva, we all know, lived, he was a little boy in the time of the temple. Many of the sages were killed years and years later. So we, I think many of us have this image in our mind. The Romans took 10 people, they lined them up, they one, two, three, goodbye. We're killing, it's not at all what happened. This is a story that takes place over 150 years. They lived in different places. It's very strange where this concept then comes from of Asarah HaRuge Malchut, that they had 10 martyrs. Of course, anybody who was into math a little bit, I don't know if anybody actually noticed it, this morning, if you read Arzei Havanon, the Asarah HaRuge Malchut, right, who's buried in Grant's tomb, when was the war of 1812? So how many 10 martyrs are there? The answer, of course, is 8. 8. Count them. I challenge you, if you're bored in the middle of what I'm saying, take out the keynote and an Arzei Havanon, and you'll count, you'll only find 8 rabbis. So that's very interesting, that the Asarah HaRuge Malchut consists of 8 rabbis. Okay, that's just a side issue out of interest. I do want to focus really on one theological issue, and then I want to discuss really what we can learn, what some of the messages, who these Asarah HaRuge Malchut were, who some of them were, and maybe some of the stories that are well known, what can we make practical for our life. Now, it's interesting, of course, the version we read on Yom Kippur and the version we read on Tisha B'Av also are quite different. The one on Yom Kippur does have 10 people, but the one on Tisha B'Av only has 8. Eila Eskara, that we say on Yom Kippur, has a very long introduction. Until you get to the actual killing of our sages, it takes you a number of paragraphs. I remember these great people, and I pour out, you know. And first of all, we have to figure why do we read this on Yom Kippur? So that's, I understand on Tisha B'Av, I just went through a whole talk how Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur are the exact opposites. The whole everything is different. Our liturgy is very different. Yom Kippur is Hashem, Hashem, Rachum V'Chanun, over and over again. God is merciful, God is close, God is wonderful. And Tisha B'Av, where is God? Where did you go, God? You promised us this, and you didn't do this, and you didn't do that. All the complaining we have in the keynote. So why in the world do we say the Asarah HaRuge Malchut on Yom Kippur? Anybody know, by the way? Why do we say Asarah HaRuge Malchut on Yom Kippur? It's late, it's interactive, you know. I have to. So one reason is that the Gemara says that the mita of a tzaddik is mechaper, that when a righteous person dies, it serves as an atonement. Yom Kippurim is a day of atonement. The death of a righteous person serves as atonement. That's very nice. But what is that? Like hokey pokey? So then we want all the righteous people should all die. Get lots of atonement here. So what do you mean a righteous person dies to get an atonement? So of course this relates to the real theme. Ah, yes. Ah, excellent. So some of the Midrashim have that some of them died on Yom Kippur. That is correct. That some of them were actually killed on Yom Kippur. So that's good. But not all of them. Yeah. Okay. Why should the death of a righteous person, why should that serve as an atonement? So really, it's because Yom Kippur is about tshuva. Because the whole purpose, I often mention this, the whole purpose of Avelus and Tshuva, as Rabbi Hochman is really alluding to, are not contradictory themes. They go together. Death is a necessary part of God's creation, because without death we would never do Tshuva. You procrastinate, as Rabbi Zadar was saying, or Eli, I don't remember who said what anymore. I remember what they said, but who said what is a little bit harder. Right? How today is our last day. We have to live each day that it might be our last day. If we didn't have that notion of death, we would never be like that. So death is, and plus we focus. When somebody dies, you go into a shiva house, people, the family comes together, people are thinking, you're natural to think about what life is all about. So death is very good on the tshuva process. That's, of course, the basis of the Medrash, Vayar Elohim et kol asher asah v'hineh tov ma'od. And God saw that all that He had did, and it was very good, the beginning of Bereishit, and the Medrash says, Tov Ma'od, what was very good? Zuhamita. Very good is death. This is an amazing Medrash the greatness of creation is manifest in death. We know death is necessary. It's very tragic for the individual, but it's necessary for our society to grow and function, for new blood to take over. So death is necessary. It helps us in the tshuva process. So that's why we read it on Yom Kippur. It's a form of tshuva. We read it for a different reason on Tisha B'Av. We don't really read it. We read it as a veilus. On Tisha B'Av, we're reading Asara Harugei Malchut. It's mourning. So we don't give introductions. A terrible tragedy happened. On Yom Kippur, we begin with this introduction about what's the purpose of it. Because if on Yom Kippur the purpose is tshuva, so we have to know why did the Asara Harugei Malchut, which we haven't quite figured out since, in other words, when did the Asara Harugei Malchut enter into our lexicon? There was never in the newspaper 10 Jews martyred, 10 Jews killed by a bomber. That never happened. Because it didn't happen like that. No, they didn't live in the same. There was nobody alive for all 10 of them. So, when did this happen? What is this exactly? This is Sarah Harugei Malchut that we all read about. So, in Yom Kippur, we have to find some link and some connecting fashion that will tell us what we have to do our tshuva for. On Tisha B'Av, we don't have to know why. We just don't know. It's a tragedy. We're saying it because we're mourning the death of righteous people, the loss of leadership. There may be an opportunity for kapara, but there's a total, we don't know what to go anymore. We don't know what's going to be. When Moshe Rabbeinu died, they forgot many halachot. When great leader dies, there's often a vacuum. And the tragedy often in Jewish history is successors are not groomed. And the great leaders die. And organizations fall apart, things happen. So that, yeah, we have to groom, we have to see the loss of leadership leaves a tremendous void. And if too many leaders die at the same time, you're really in trouble. They die over time, replace them a little bit. When they die all at once, then we're in trouble. So I'm sure you all know that on Yom Kippur, the Paitan tells the story that, which of course can't be true. Right? It can't be literally true. The Paitan tells the story how Roman emperor came, Gavale Begolim, Itimalim, Karala Saracha Chamim Gedolim. He gathered together 10 sages, Mipneita Tutameh Bepilpulim, people who were in Pilpul learning, very learned, our learned rabbis. Dinubi Mishpat Selashro, he says, he wants to know, Kimotzi Lamitopal Roy, want to know what is the truth, what is the light of Torah. He says, what's the halach if you kidnap somebody? What is the law if somebody kidnaps and sells somebody? So the rabbi said, what's the law? The law is motumot, one who kidnaps and sells a person gets a death penalty. That's what it says in the Chumash. So the Roman emperor said, what happened to the 10 brothers who sold Yosef? Hey, they kidnapped somebody, they sold him. And we know the Avodah kept Torah, right? Everybody knows that. We kept the Torah before it was given. So what's going on? What happened to them? They sold him to a caravan of Yishmaelites, which is also a very interesting question. Who exactly sold him? That's on Parshanut of Yosef. This is based on a pasuk in Amos that Al Mikram, the Kes of Tzadik, that they sold a tzaddik, Yosef a tzaddik, as our rabbis interpret, for a bunch of shoes. In the Chumash, it doesn't say that. They sold him for a bunch of shoes to get some shoes. We don't wear shoes on Tisha B'Av or Yom Kippur. Shoes is the mastery of man. It's the control. We can control. When you're in a place of holiness, in the Beis Hamikdash, you couldn't wear shoes. When God appears to Moshe, you can't wear shoes. Shoes is man is in control. Barefoot is God is in control. They sold Yosef for shoes because they wanted to be in control. It's also, of course, there in the Navi means that for a lousy pair of shoes, they sold the brother. But Tem Kiblu Din Shamayim Aleichem, and now he says, you know, we have to have punishment here. We have to have the punishment, we have to have a bathing, we're a righteous nation. We want to observe the laws of the Torah. So says the Roman emperor. We want to observe what it says. V'imayu b'chayim ayiti danan nitnechem. The Roman emperor says, listen, I have nothing against you 10 rabbis. I don't have anything. If these 10 brothers were alive today, who sold them, I would kill them. What can I do? They died already. I have to kill you instead. You will bear the guilt, the sin of your forefathers. So when the rabbi says, give us 3 days, let us know if the heavens are decreeing that this is true. It's here also the rhyme, if we are guilty, we're willing to have tolerance, have savanut, we will bear the decree of one who is full of mercy, we'll bear the decree of God. The story of the Asar Harug and Malchut is based on a medrash. Medrash Eli Estera, which is printed in the back here, my keynote, it's about 20 pages. It's based on Midrashim, based on many, many times, that the Paitan took poetic license to and put it into a form of poetry. The Medrash describes Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol was the first one who was killed, the earliest one, of course, who was living in the time of the temple. That's the only way he could be a Kohen Gadol. That he was chosen to go up to Shemaim. The Medrash has a beautiful story, how his parents couldn't have any children, couldn't conceive, and they felt that they weren't living a life of total purity, and to decide they're going to go, the mother's going to go into mikveh all the time. They're going to go to the mikveh, and the Gemara tells the story, she goes to the mikveh, and she came out and she saw the pig walking by. She went back to the mikveh, back and over again. And eventually she had Rabbi Shmuel. I think the Gemara says he's one of the seven most beautiful people who ever lived. You don't just say that on men. One of the most very, very beautiful men. So he was sent up to Shamayim to find out if this is true. And of course, we know that apparently it was true. And they came back, and then the Kina goes through how they were killed. Of course, in the middle, they said, enough already. This is too much, and we can't take it. And God said, be quiet, or I'll be master the world, the tohu uvohu. I'll return the world into emptiness and nothingness. Now, I just want to raise a problem. That's what I'm going to say is really, I'm not going to say it as well, but based on Schneer Lyman, on Dr. Lyman, who's one of the master scholars of our time, so he has a tape on the Asura Harugin Malchut. So he raises, it goes into a lot of detail, a lot of issues we won't really get into, but he discusses, this is a very serious theological problem, what we just read in the Asura Harugin Malchut. The notion of vicarious punishment, that you should die, these 10 rabbis should die for the sins of 10 earlier brothers. We know that one of the major revolutions of Judaism, I always like to hear how the Torah was given in a specific time and place. While we believe the Torah, of course, is eternal for all times, it was given to a specific group of people who had a specific historical consciousness. And there were many things that we take for granted that are in the Torah that are only for granted because they're in the Torah. Because the Torah revolutionized the world. And so things that we take for obvious were very not obvious in the time of the Torah. And one of the things that was very not obvious in the time of the Torah is that the notion, it was very normal, vicarious punishment. You kill A for the sins of B. That we know now in Hammurabi's code that let's say you were putting up a building and the building, Rahman al-Islam, collapsed and it killed the guy's, his son. So what would they do? They would take your son and kill him. Rahman al-Islam. This is what they would do to punish. You killed his son, they killed your son. Because in that culture, they believe that the father owned the family. Not so, you know, if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense, right? They owned his wife, he owned his children. It was an extension of his property. The rest of the family didn't have an individuality. And the Torah came along and said, absolutely nothing doing. Lo yamtu avoda banim valim lo yamtu al achet avotam. Pasuk in Kitesei. Children shall not be put to death for the sins of the fathers, and the fathers for the sins of the children. Ish becheto yumat. Every person can only be killed for their own sin. The notion that A suffers for B is a very un-Jewish notion. We think it, more questions. We think it as a Christian notion, yes. Okay, we'll get there. We'll go, good. That's so, Hashem can do it, but man can't. Yeah, that's one answer.
No, I'm saying, why didn't the rabbi, instead of saying, I'll come back for an answer after 3 days, why did he quote that and say, everyone should die for their own sins?
This was a Jewish, that is exactly the problem in a sense I'm raising. The Paitan seems to accept this notion that they were killed because of the what they did to the brothers. I think everybody knows that. And seeing, you ask people, what's the sort of is the punchline of the suffering? Yeah, you know, the story, right? They sold Yosef, so we do it instead of Yosef. By the way, there were only 9 brothers who sold Yosef. There were not 10 brothers who sold Yosef. There were a total of 12 brothers, and Binyamin is at home. And Yosef doesn't count. He wasn't involved. We can't blame him. So we're already down at the 10. And Reuven wasn't there. Reuven with his father. That's why he came back. So there were really only 9 brothers who sold Yosef. But that's okay. Let's not be bothered on technicalities. What is this notion of vicarious punishment that the Kina is putting in? So the simple answer, the basic answer is that's correct. That's this halakha is on a Beit Din. A Jew, as a matter of fact, it's what do you mean loyim tu'avot? We just leaned, how many hours ago, whenever we had mincha? Just now. Okay, ravon avon avanim. It's in the Aser that, we just read it in Vayichal. God brings the sins of the parents on the children. So what do you mean? We don't have vicarious punishment? Of course we do. But one is God. And one is man. Man can never punish A for B. That's the basis of a Jewish ethical system is not to allow that. God has his own wisdom. God is Ochse Machse Avotechem. God says, I can do it, but God says, you know what? It's not that God is punishing. God says, this generation deserves punishment. I'm nice. Let's see what happens. Let's hold off. Next generation. Haven't improved much. Let's hold it up again. Finally, how much patience does God have? He doesn't have indefinite patience, like Ellie Carpenter said. Not going to be here indefinitely. Okay, so God, now all that punishment that they really should have had 5 generations ago, or 3 generations ago, we're getting it now. So that is the notion that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can carry out such a thing, but a Beit Din can't carry it. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu only carries it out im ochsim v'maseh avotechem, if we're following in the ways of our forefathers. If we do tshuva, of course we can annul the sins. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu will do it if we haven't learned the lesson. Yes, you wanted to ask something. Okay, no. All right. Okay, now, what Dr. Lyman explains, which I'll do extremely briefly, is basically what we have here is we know that in Christianity, the whole notion that their God died for the sins of others, that's the whole religion is based on that. You have to have faith, he died for our sins, that's what everything is based on in Christianity. It basically says this kina is an anti-Christian polemic in many ways. This was the kina done to go against the notion of vicarious punishment. And that's why you have the story of the Roman emperor. The Roman emperor is sitting and learning a pasuk in Chumash. Like he's got a kasha on the Chumash. It says in Parshat Mishpatim that he knows, go nevi shumacharomot yumad. Oh, he remembers in Vayeshev, they saw the brothers. And what does Rashi say on the pasuk? Okay, he couldn't have asked that. But what's going on here? So we know that the Christians took our Bible. And they misinterpreted our Bible. They took the Torah, they replaced it. That's the Old Testament. We have a New Testament, new and improved. That was the whole Christian belief. And that we suffer because of the sins of not accepting their God. That's why the Jewish people are suffering. That we heard it also, you have it in the Kina too. The Goyim said that. From their perspective, it makes a lot of sense. Where's your God? And that's what we mentioned earlier in the keynote in the morning. Yecheskel says, we're giving you back there to say, not because you deserve it. We don't deserve it. You're getting it back as it's a chilul Hashem. God has had enough of the desecration of his name by the goyim saying, where's God? He had it already. God is sick and tired of hearing that. So fine, I'll show you I'm still around. And I haven't forgotten who the Jewish people are. This was the whole Christian polemic against the Jew. And they said, and the notion of, so they have the Roman taking the Torah and saying, we have to, of course, that's the misinterpretation of the Torah. Because that's only God who can give the extra punishment. And of course, what's the tie-in into Yosef? The tie-in into Yosef is, what's the sin of Yosef? No? What's the sin of Yosef? It's sinat chinam. Hatred of the brothers. What greater sinat chinam is there than Yosef? Why do we go down to Egypt? Why everything? Sinat chinam, the brothers. It's a terrible story. It's a tragic story. So we come along. You know why the base of me is destroyed? Not because they sold Yosef. Because we sell Yosef every day. We care about our pair of shoes as opposed to giving a tzedakah. That's what we care about. Because we are oksei masei avoteyem. We do the same sins of Yosef. So the Paitan puts in this notion of Yosef. Yeah, but that's not it. It's because we are following in the pathway of Yosef. We're doing the same sinat chinam. That's what Tisha B'Av is all about. Tisha B'Av is on sinat chinam. And that was the problem. But that way we're being punished because we're ochsei masei avoteichem. When will God have vicarious punishment? When we don't learn from the previous generation. So that's what's going on here. This story didn't happen. It's not a true story. There are no 10 people who were ever killed. This never. It's over 150 years. But looking back, there were many more than 10 people killed with the Romans. Over thousands. You'll read in the keynote. You have really more on the first page. How many people were killed? Thousands and thousands of people were killed. What do you mean 10 rabbis? Much more than 10 rabbis. But apparently these 10 rabbis were chosen for their greatness and their piety, and that we can say that their mita is a kapara, or their mita we have to lay it over us to do tshuva. But the Paitan is not writing this to write a historical fact. The Paitan is writing that we Jews should know our answer to the Christians is, you know what, they're right. If we follow in the ways of our forefathers and we don't learn from the sale of Yosef, God will punish us for the sins of others. But only God can punish us. No court can punish us. The Romans took our Torah. The Roman, of course, we all know in the Midrashim that Rome is identified with on Christianity, and of course that's how it developed. So they took the Torah and they misused the whole Torah. So that's perhaps you don't listen. If you don't, and you, either you can accept this interpretation or not. But I thought it's a very interesting idea. And of course, it's a powerful, it's an important idea. That don't think just the brother sold Yosef, but we would never sell our brothers. So again, you don't have to sell your brother to sell your brother. We don't have that opportunity. We do it in different ways. We stab people in the back, and we curse them out, and we cheat them in business. We do all kinds of things to sell our brothers. Okay, we don't sell them to Egypt. Alright, that was part of a divine plan, the way it worked out. So that's it. That's the Asar HaRugamachu. For us to do tshuva, we're mourning, we're still sinning, we haven't learned too much. Tisha B'Av, we don't really say all this. Tisha B'Av, there's no mention of the sale of brothers or anything. Yes?
Can I come back to the immigration punishment? Is it really satisfactory to say that why is it not okay for an earthly
God
to do that? It's fine for God to do that.
In other words, is it acceptable to say that God that is not bound by the laws of the Torah? So that's a discussion beyond the scope of our talk that I don't know if I'm qualified to fully answer. On the one level, of course, the answer is yes, God can do whatever he wants. I mean, that obviously the justice system of God is different than the man justice system. That's the whole nature. It has to be. God, because God sees the whole picture. We don't see the whole picture. We only see what's in front of us. So God has a much broader picture. So obviously the answer is yes, God can do. It's not that God isn't doing justice. It's what appears to us is injustice. It's not really injustice. The vicarious punishment of God is not an injustice. It's just from our perspective, it looks to be unjust. But it isn't. Because God has the whole view of history. So that's the simple answer, I think. On the other hand, we do know that we often say, how can God, we said it in the keynote, God is bound by this. God made a promise. God has to follow the rules. So the truth of the matter is the answer I give is not the only answer, and the Gemara does talk about it more in the end. The Makkos talks about how Yechezkel came and he nullified this. If you read the Gemara in Makkos, the end of Makkos, the Gemara said that Moshe Rabbeinu did four things, and people came, they threw out, it sounds like they're changing the whole Torah here. They threw out, by Yechezkel ubitla. And the simple reading of the Gemara is that Yechezkel said, okay, I won't do that anymore. It says in Torah, okay, Rabbanim, and that was in those days. Now we live in a more cultured world. We don't do, that's what it almost sounds like. I mean, this is like, so this you have to learn, you have to figure out what the Gemara is. The Gemara is troubled by this notion, that not everybody says that answer, that one is God and one is not. But that is the simple approach to it. You're right, the questions, as I say, the questions, especially on Tisha B'Av, are great answer. We don't really know when it comes. I said those who are here in the morning, that we don't ask why. That's an inappropriate question. We don't ask lama, but we ask lima. For what purpose? We don't ask why God did it. We ask, now that God did it, what are we going to do about it? Now that the World Trade Center is destroyed, what are we going to do about it? Now that there's suicide bombing, what are we going to do about it? Not why it happened. We can't answer that question. And it's ridiculous, and it's a waste of time thinking and answer. The only thing you can possibly do is look, what are we doing wrong? What's in, but even that is very hard. Without a Navi, it's very hard to know exactly. So we have to introspect ourselves. But that's a little bit of the background of, perhaps a little bit of the background of the Isara Haruge Mahud. It's clearly a poetic license giving us Musar, that we're carrying on the sins, unfortunately, of our forefathers. It's part of, unfortunately, Jewish history. That's why we had to go to Egypt to get rid of it. We didn't fully get rid of it. And, of course, it has the imagery. It's very powerful when you read it, as the emotion and the power of 10 of our greatest sages, although so some of them, like, nobody's ever heard of. Like, you know, when you read, who is that? I never heard of him. But all the famous ones, Rabbi Kiva, will come to him. So that everybody heard of. But it's a very... This is not made up. They were killed. But it's not exactly in the way it's presented in the Kina. But I just want to give a... I want to now go perhaps on the second part, what we can learn from all this, a little bit. I just want to... I guess we just have time maybe to discuss 3 points. The Mechilta, this is a very scary rabbinic interpretation. And Rav Soloveitchik has it, and he puts in his beautiful imagery. The Mechilta, we mentioned how Rabbi Shimon, how Rabbi Yishmael Kohen Gadol was the first to be killed. Him and Rabbi Gamliel were being led out to be killed. And the Mechilta in Parshat in Mishpatim, we'll see what it's doing there in a moment. The Mechilta is the rabbinic interpretation, the interpretation of Chazal on the Chumash, basically. So the Mechilta is talking about anatana. You're not allowed to afflict. It's talking there about orphans and widows, and it uses a double language, like the Torah often does. Hashev tashev, azov tazov, patoch tiftach, etc. Very often the Torah emphasizes, give tzedakah more than once, return it more than once, help more than once. Anatana, don't afflict the person more than once. So the Mechilta says, echad, why does it say twice, don't hurt somebody, don't hurt somebody? So echad inui meruba, echad inui inimuat. Whether it's a little bit of hurt or a lot of hurt, it doesn't make a difference. It's for I only hit him a little bit. Only stole a few $1,000s. I'm honest, 95% of the time. What do you want from me, right? Davar acher imanatanah. Then the measure says another thing. Imanatanah magi she'elo chayav ad she'yana biyishta. Now we say a lighter interpretation. You have to do it twice. God won't punish you the first time. If you do it twice, anatana, then we'll punish you. So now the Medrash quotes the story. Kvar haya Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Shimon, not Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Shimon, Yotzim Leherak. Leherak. They were going out together to be killed as the first two of the 10 martyrs who were being killed. Amalo Rabbi Shimon, the Rabbi Shimon. So Rabbi Shimon turned to Rabbi Shimon and says, Rabbi, my master, my teacher, Libi Yotzim, my heart is going out. I do not know why I'm being killed. God doesn't take righteous people and kill them. You see, they do. They hear they were asking the question. God doesn't kill for no reason. What did I do wrong? I'm a righteous person, and that's not a lack of humility. Moshe knew he was a great person. It's how you act on that. That's Mark Van Pupu. What did he do? What did I do that's so terrible? And that's what we say in the keynote. Yes, we're not so good, but we do many wonderful things. We do give tons of stuff, as we spoke earlier. We do wonderful things. Are we so bad? The going are 10 times worse. Why do we have to suffer so much? Enough, God, already. So Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Shimon says, I don't know what I did so bad. So Amar Rabbi Yishmael, the Rabbi Shimon. So Rabbi Shimon says to Rabbi Shimon, I'll give you a suggestion. Meyamecha, did it ever once happen in your days, Lo ba adam etzlecha ladino l'sheila, that somebody called you for a shayla? They had a corker. They wanted to know if the pots and pans. You know, that's the essence, as Ellie was talking about. The pots and pans, are they kosher? Can I eat a Snickers bar if I'm matbid on Chalav Yisrael? Whatever. They have some very earth-shattering, you know, question. Ladino l'sheila. Bachbato, atchitei gomeya kosech, o atchitei no el sandalecha. And you said, you know what? I'll call you back. I just have to take off my I have to finish. I'm in the middle of having a cup of coffee. Gomea kosecha to finish my cup, or take off my shoes. Again, the imagery of the shoe. See the master. Or I have to take off my shoe, but to relax, as the Rav says. Imagine the rabbi comes home and it's been a hard day of work, He's been tripping, driving crazy and teaching, working hard, 10 hours. He walks into the house, fine, he's going to give hello to his kids and his wife. And all of a sudden, the phone rings, and he's just about to eat supper. He's starving, he didn't eat lunch, he's just about to eat supper, and the phone rings, and somebody with a shiloh. So you tell your wife, tell them I'll call them back in 5 minutes. Just let me have a cup of water. So that's what Rabbi Yishmael did. I'll call you back in 5 minutes. Just let me take off my shoes. I have to relax so I can think of the shiloh. To put on a piece of clothing. I have to put on my shirt. I'm half naked. It's in the morning. I'm on my way to shul. I'm in my underwear. I'll call you when I get to shul. Yeah, I'm not up yet. But the Torah says, if you afflict, if you hurt somebody, whether you hurt them a lot, whether a little. So what did Rabbi Shimon answer? Nichamtani Rabbi, you have comforted me. Now I can die. I know what I did wrong. I didn't answer the Shaila right away. I said, wait 5 minutes, I'll come to you. You have comforted me. This Mechilta is so scary. Unbelievable. The responsibility that we have not to hurt somebody. I've mentioned it before, I know, on Tisha B'Av. The notion of call waiting really bothers me. I can't stand it. I shouldn't say it like this. I think it's extremely rude. You know, before they invented it, you could live, you'll call the person back, so they'll get a busy, and today they don't have to even get a busy signal. The call goes automatically to the answer machine. They're talking to somebody, and I'll call you back. I think that, I don't know. And the only person you can put on call waiting is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When can you put HaKadosh Baruch Hu on call waiting? Who put him on call waiting? It's Abraham. Abraham Avinu was talking to God. God came here to visit him after the third day of the Brit Milah. And Abraham sees three strangers, three idol worshippers, right? Who he was going to charge if they don't bench, right? So he sees the three idol worshippers. And he said, God, sorry, I can't talk to you now. That's a good call waiting. So you're learning Gemara, and a Shaila comes up. That's good call waiting. You close your Gemara. They asked in the beginning of the turn of the century, some journalist interviewed a few of the Gedolim, and he asked them, what's the most important job of a rabbi? So the Aruch HaShulchan said, the Rabbi Yaakov Yechiel Michal Epstein, the great posek who was, and it's really more popular than the Mishnah Berurah. Now the Mishnah Berurah has become much more popular. The Aruch HaShulchan was the posek, really. So the job of rabbi is to sit and learn, to learn the Paskin Shilas. And that's Rav Chaim Brisker, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, who recreated the world of learning, who totally refashioned the world of thinking with his learning. Rav Chaim said, you know what the most important job of a rabbi is? Social justice. It's to fight for the widow and the poor and to stand up at the party when somebody's being thrown out and to say, I'm not going to take this and you're not going to get away with it. And the Rav has in Halachic Man, where he describes the ideal halachic, you know, personality. He has a famous story there that there was once in Brisk that a simple person died, and the Chevra Kedisha is preparing the funeral, and an hour later the biggest baltstuck in the community died. So the family of the biggest baltstuck said, oh, we'll do our funeral first, it's more of a couple. Yeah, we're in the Chevra Kedisha, of course, I mean, obviously. And Rav Chaim said, no, you won't. Rav Chaim said, the poor man died first. I don't care. He died first. He's going to be buried first. Chevra Kedisha said, you're going to tell us what to do. We run the community. We hired you. We're your boss. Rav Chaim said, no, you're not. I'm the rabbi here. And when somebody dies, he gets buried first. And Rav Chaim said, under my dead body, will you bury the rich person first? That's the most important job of a rabbi. That's what a rabbi has to be concerned for the welfare. Anetane, the little poor widow. So you're learning Gadaf Gemara, you close the Gemara. Yeah, that's you close the Gemara and you go help somebody. That's Rabbi Lichtenstein always used to say, if you want to sit and learn all day, don't become a rabbi. Don't. Become a Rosh Yeshiva even. Then you have to be a fundraiser. Okay. So become a Rebbe in a yeshiva. No, I'm serious. I know people. They don't want to be a Rosh Yeshiva. Who wants to fundraise all day? So they become a Rebbe in a yeshiva to sit and learn. You want to become a rabbi, you can't learn all day. You have to spend time doing other things. Some things are very good and some things just are not so good, but that's what you have to do if you want to become. That's the way it works. So this is what the Asar HaRuhi Malchut, Nichamtani Rebbe, you comforted me. You comforted me with your words by telling me that unbelievable. Now this notion, Lechama, of course, is most famous from Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva, of course, is the most famous of the 10 martyrs. And we know the famous story about Akiva Nichamtanu, Akiva Nichamtanu. Now, you know, when it's almost the end of the day. We'll be having food in 2 hours. Okay? So not a 2-minute warning, a 2-hour warning. Okay, so you know, I don't know if the mood, I don't think it really changes, but there is sort of a, we look forward already, the other day we're looking forward to the Geula, whatever, it's maybe, we've said enough of the keynote already, so we know that Tisha B'Av is a strange concept. You know, Tisha B'Av, somebody asked me before about Slichas, before somebody asked, there are no Slichas on Tisha B'Av, interestingly enough. We don't say Tachanun on Tisha B'Av. Why don't we say Tachanun on Tisha B'Av? Because it's a pasuk in Eicha, kara alai moed. Because Tisha B'Av is a holiday. Moed, like Pesach and Sukkot. It's a moed. It's a holiday. Now we know Zechariah Navi says it will be a holiday one day, but it's not a moed when it will be a holiday. It's a moed now. Right now, Tisha B'Av is a holiday. We don't say Tachanun. Very, 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 very strange. And but you know, I always think. Of all our rabbinic figures, and perhaps this is why he's so so popular, if I can use such an expression, the person who most represents hope for the future, and no matter what happens, we move on, is Rabbi Akiva. I mean, you have to picture the life of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, I'm going to say, he witnessed actually 2 Holocausts. Rabbi Akiva, 2, not 1. One, Rabbi Akiva was killed in the Bar Kokhba in the revolt, approximately 133, 135, somewhere around there. We know he lived to be 120. The first 40 years, he was an ignoramus, as he wanted to bite, as one of our speakers said, to bite the Torah scholars. He didn't care about Torah. The next 40 years, he sat and learned. And the third 40 years, he taught. So Rabbi Akiva, if he died in 135, that means he was born in the year 15. So I always find this amazing. I think I mentioned sort of. That means, what was he doing in the year 70? The year the temple was built, which he witnessed, of course. He wasn't a little baby. He was 55 years old. What was Rabbi Akiva doing at the age of 55? This is very interesting. I don't know. I just, you think about it. What was he doing? He was sitting and learning. He was in the middle of the 24 years. You know, when he left his wife, he got married, and, you know, he went, I assume, he was sitting and learning Torah. Rabbi Akiva lived through the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And he lived through the Bar Kokhba revolt. And he suffered a horrific death. But what does Rabbi Akiva say on his deathbed? Thank you, God. Thank you, God. The one mitzvah I couldn't do. I couldn't give my life unto God. I mean, it's mind-boggling that he was happy. He's going to die doing a mitzvah. And the famous story how he was teaching Torah and the fish and the fox. And our whole life led teaching Torah. And then who was with him in jail told him, Rabbi Akiva, you're a lucky guy. You're going to get killed. You're in jail because you teach Torah. I'm in jail because I'm a common criminal. It's worthless. What did I get from it? To die, to teach Torah, to have that opportunity to teach is unbelievable. And to be to have that opportunity. But the most famous story, we all know that the Gemara at the end of Machos, how Rabbi Akiva was walking with 4 of his friends, great rabbis, great Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Tarfon, I believe the Gemara mentions, and they saw the foxes running out of the base of Midrash. That's a pasuk in Eicha. Shualim Hilchubo. We just read it last night. The foxes were running outside of the base HaMikdash, and of course the rabbis were crying. Everybody knows the story, but we have to say it anyways. Rabbi Akiva, his friends were crying, and Rabbi Akiva was laughing. I mean, you have to picture here the scene. You're walking by, and these people all witnessed the destruction of the temple. It's like you walk by, it's not even such a lahabdil, it is a lahabdil to a certain degree, but okay, a lahabdil. You walk by at the World Trade Center, you walk by Ground Zero, 3,000 people were killed here, all right, let's have a party. That's what Rabbi Akiva is doing. He's laughing. The Beis HaMikdash that they just witnessed, they used to go there all the time. They brought korbanos there, that's destroyed, and Rabbi Akiva is having a good time. They're furious at him. Why are you laughing? I mean, I can't believe they said that to him. I don't know why they didn't lift him up and throw him on his head. But they said to him, why are you crying?
Why are you crying? I said, why are we crying? So everybody knows why we're crying. Surely Miyachubo, the fox are going to say, yeah, that's why I laugh. I'm laughing because I know now the nevuah, no matter how bad it is, sort of, the worse it gets, the better it will be. And the Rav talks about this a lot. The dialectic of at the lowest moments, we move forward, and at the highest moments, we move down. At the wedding, we break the glass. At the moment of joy, at the height of destruction, or in mourning, we move forward. We proclaim the greatness of God. We say the Kaddish. The Mashiach is born and Tishbav. It takes a great man to see what can come out of it. He wasn't the way I did it. He wasn't laughing at the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, but he had a smile. He knew that we would grow. And from this experience, and of course, what do the sages say to him? Nicham, Akiva Nichamtanu, Akiva Nichamtanu. They say it twice. I always find it interesting. He's always, when you have that a few times in the Gemara, when they always refer to him as Akiva, not like Rabbi Akiva, it's Akiva. Because I guess they knew him when he was up to 40, he was out playing ball. He wasn't like serious in the yeshiva at the beginning. So Akiva Nichamtanu. Akiva could have faith. And in the future, amidst witnessing two destructions, it's hard enough to build after one. But that is quite an amazing, and that's why Rabbi Akiva is such a symbol. But of course, Rabbi Akiva also, the Mishnah says in Yuma, it's when the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, so Rabbi Akiva says, don't worry, Ashrecham Yisrael, blessed are, Mimetarachem, who purifies you, Abinu Shemam. You don't need the Beis Hamikdash, let's stick some stones. God, you do real tshuva, you don't need any Beis Hamikdash. Abinu Shavashman. Rabbi Akiva is always there with the words of comfort to cheer up the Jewish people. And we know that after being away for 24 years from his wife, with the encouragement of his wife, he cannot do that unless your wife agrees to it. So the wife encouraged him to stay away for 24 years. And I don't know if it means he never started, even though the famous story, but I don't know. But anyway, he was learning for 24 years, and when he came back to 24,000 students, I don't know if that's a coincidence, 24,000 of his students, and everybody's coming, and this woman was coming to see, and you get in the back of the line, behind the mechitza there, and Rabbi Akiva says, no, Shali v'shalachem shala. Of course, it's beautiful in Hebrew, Shali v'shalachem, what's mine and yours is shala. The learning, everything that I've done, my greatness is only because of her, which we know is very true, and it's only because of her. Rabbi Akiva saw that, and Rabbi Akiva could teach, a man who witnesses murder and destruction to teach the faith in humanity, love your neighbor yourself, what a powerful lesson. The one whose 24,000 students died because they couldn't get along with another. Sinat Chinam again, the rabbis, lo nagu kavod zeh bezeh, and Rabbi Akiva could have that faith, to love our neighbor as herself. So he could maintain that as the most important pasuk, is the key defining moment of the Jewish people. It's interesting, we have an amazing halacha. We're learning in the morning before, in the weeks leading up to Tisha B'Av, those who were learning with me know how much I emphasize this halacha. You can get engaged, and not just engaged, you can have kiddushin. You can go up to a girl on Tisha B'Av and say, Harei at mikudeshet li betavazu kedat Moshe Yisrael, with two witnesses. Can't have a chuppah. You know, our wedding ceremony is two parts. We now do it as one. But it's really halachically two different parts. So the halach is, you can get married. You're legally married. If the woman has an affair, she gets a death penalty. This is a real marriage, not an engagement. That's your halach. You're sitting in the middle of kinot, and you see a cute girl in shul, and you say, come. I want to propose. And you call out two guys in the middle of Kinderse, Arzeh Havana, and they're crying, the Asar Harugim up, they're killed. Hold on, we're making a wedding over here, can you come out? What kind of craziness is this? Okay, the Jewish people are mourning, and you're sitting there worrying about, is the girl good looking, do you like her, does she have enough money? I shouldn't say all these things, but whatever, you're worried. Is she a fine midot and a talmidah chachama? Whatever you're looking for in a girl. I assume that the girls are looking at the guys, so the girls are looking down at the guys. What's he like? So whatever. So this is what you're doing on Tisha B'Av? It makes no sense. But of course, what the halacha is emphasizing, what's marriage? Marriage is the continuity of the Jewish people. Marriage represents we cannot be destroyed as a people. that when we went into slavery in Egypt, Yocheved and Amram separated. Who can bring children into an evil world? And Miriam said, you're worse than Paro. Paro's only killing all the boys. You're killing the boys and the girls. So they got married again. And they had Moshe Rabbeinu. So that's the power. That's why we get married on Tisha B'Av. Yeah, we mourn in the morning, and there's a Churban, and the 10 martyrs were killed, and we have tragedies in the Spanish expulsion and the Holocaust. But as we said, we're still here. We're here at 7:30 on Tisha B'Av talking, and we're going to go home and eat soon. We've triumphed. We have the state of Israel. We have yeshivas. We have black kosher Snickers, not Snickers. I don't know. Everything you want. Dunkin' Donut. Everything you want, you can have. You can live a great, wonderful life. The Jewish people cannot be defeated. And Tisha B'Av has that message of hope. It's a moed. Tisha B'Av is a holiday. Rabbi Akiva in martyrdom tells us, don't worry, we have a future, because the real world is Olam Haba. We make it, that's where the Olam Hafu, right? This world is an upside down, tipsy-topsy world. So we Jews can get married, can get engaged. You can't have the party. Can't be. You have to wait till after Tisha B'Av the party. So anybody wants to, we still have a couple hours left, so anybody who wants to take advantage of that, you have all my blessings. I'll be one of the witnesses. If you trust me as a kosher witness, I'm willing to do so. That's what it says, black and white in the Shulchan Aruch. And it's not like, it's not in the joke book. Like it's not, and it's not in the Mishnah Berurah. It's in the Shulchan Aruch itself. So they can get married. The Jewish, individual Jews have been killed and martyred. They're martyred in Israel, unfortunately, way too often. Let's hope the quiet continues. Whatever you think of the roadmap, let's hope that at least it's not so, it's quieter. Let's hope that it gets even quieter. That individual Jews are martyred and suffer, but Judaism can never be destroyed. And Tisha B'Av gives us hope. Akiva Nichamtanu, Akiva was killed, but Akiva Nichamtanu, Akiva, you have comforted us. Akiva, you have comforted us. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu bring us all comfort. We can celebrate the holiday of Tisha B'Av is a real moed in a rebuilt Beit HaMikdash b'mehera b'yameinu. Amen. Okay.